Bonjour, and thank you very much to everyone for coming today. I am Emily Shapiro, and I'm the executive editor of the journal American Art. It's a journal that's published by the Smithsonian Institution and the University of Chicago Press 3 times a year. And it covers topics in all media, but they must relate in some way to American art or art of the United States more particularly. My best experience is as the editor of this journal, but I do have colleagues both in the university presses in the United States and at other art history journals in the States. And so I hope I can speak and represent, generally speaking, the concerns and the procedures and expectations of publishing in the United States. So this is really geared mostly toward individuals who have not had or have limited no experience or limited experience publishing, maybe at all, but certainly in the United States. And so I'm speaking primarily to what I'm expecting as an audience of people maybe writing a dissertation that they're thinking that they want to get out into the world in various forums, but much of the advice would be, I think, still applicable at a higher, more advanced level of your professional experience as well. At the beginning, I just wanted to mention the forum of book reviews. I know that book reviews are published in France. Again, I can't speak as much to the forums for them, although I do understand that they exist. But in the States, I would say that that is, of course, a book review is, frankly, the easiest opportunity to publish. And I think a very good opening opportunity for several reasons. One is that it gives you an opportunity or really pushes you to try to find a writing voice that will speak to a broad audience. And that's something that you'll need to do more in your post-doctoral work. And so I think that is very important. It's also an opportunity early on to just learn about some of the stages of a publishing process without a very serious investment on the part of you or the publisher. And finally, and this is probably obvious, but as well, it's a way to stake your claim to assert your expertise in a particular area. Of course, you're going to write a book review on something that you are interested in, that you feel like you have something to say. And so I do recommend, I mean, in the US, my journal does not publish book reviews, but many electronic and print journals do. And I know that the journals will typically say that they only publish reviews on commission, basically invitation to someone to review a book. But I don't think that's really the case. And so I do know the case to be that book review editors are always looking for new voices. And so I wouldn't be shy about contacting the book review editor at a publication that it's suited to your interests to introduce yourself, introduce your area of expertise, and perhaps I would suggest proposing a recent book or two, a specific book or two that you might be interested in reviewing. And the worst that can happen is they'll say no, and they'll probably keep your information on file regardless. So I do very much do recommend that experience. I think strategically that, you know, you don't want to spend a lot of time writing book reviews, but I could imagine doing it once or twice early in your publishing career could be helpful. And again, it's a way of associating your name with someone who's just had a book published in a related field. And your name will come up in searches along with that person's name. It actually, you know, so that can be quite helpful. I will say one thing about book reviews, though, especially for more junior scholars, but really at any stage of development, that you want to write a book review on a book that you have productive and positive things to say. Because you don't want to put yourself in a position of a serious negative critique of someone else's work, especially early in your career. So I think that the strategy is to sign on to write about a book that you admire. And of course, if you write a review, it's boring if there's not even a tiny hint of critique, but it might run along the lines of new, you know, additional areas for exploration on a particular topic. There's a way of being constructive in criticism without, you know. So you wanna only do a book review for a book that you ultimately admire, I would say. All right, scholarly articles. This is my area of particular expertise, and I'll kind of take you through the process as it works at the kind of highest calibers, as I understand it, at the highest caliber art history journals in the United States. And first, just to say again, the reason, the benefits of publishing some of your research in an article, again, this may be obvious, but sometimes people hold out for the book, and I will say that you don't want to publish all of your work in articles first, because then a book publisher won't be interested. They'll say everything's already out there. Why do we need a book? However, I think it's quite important, although not crucial, but important to release some of your scholarship as an article first. And again, there are several reasons for that. One is before you're ready to work on a book manuscript, you may have one part of your thesis that's quite developed, and so you can get that out potentially into the world, again, a way of publicly announcing your project in a way that's even more public than a talk at a conference, because it's in permanent form and searchable in more ways. Also, of course, the logic that if once you've published your book on a particular topic, then you can't publish articles from it. It only works the other way around. So if you want to maximize the number of publications that you have for your professional development, publish, you know, an article or two if you can first, and then the body of the work will be in the book, and that just gives you more exposure in the field. And also, I'll just say that I hazard to say that journal articles probably get read more than books do, just by the very nature of being shorter. And so I think that just in terms of thinking about the circulation of your work, there's a real benefit to, even I think for more senior scholars, to continue publishing not only their books, but in journals where there's kind of a set and steady readership. So then to speak about actually writing an article. So you'll have research projects, bigger or smaller, and I think really, really important for an article is to make sure that the size and the scope of the research fits the length of an article. I see not only with foreign scholars, non-US scholars' work, but with American authors' work constantly, that people try to cram or smush a 45, you know, 50-page dissertation chapter into a 20-page article, and it doesn't work. And it's obvious what is happening, is that topics are being, you know, moving from one argument to another very quickly. no sustained attention. And so it's very, I think it's a real skill, and but a really important skill to be able to identify in your work a piece of your work, a sub-argument of your larger argument, a discrete body of inquiry or research that can be considered and pursued properly and thoroughly at the length of an article. I think that's really, really important, because if you don't have a good sized topic to start, you just can't do a good job with it. So I can't emphasize that enough. And related, and this is something that, again, I see all the time, in addition to an article not being the same as a dissertation chapter or a thesis chapter, it's not the same thing as a conference paper. So, of course, I strongly, encourage people to, when they've given a conference paper, if they got a good reception, if they are happy with it, to think about trying to publish something based on that research. But I do not recommend submitting the text of that paper to a journal, at least not in the States, in the sense that, again, the voice, as I mean, you know probably from giving presentations, the voice that you use in an oral presentation is different. The kind of argument you make is slightly different. And it's, again, something where, as a readers that I employ to serve as peer reviewers, can spot something that is a conference paper, as can I, not always, I'm sure, but often. And so it makes sense to go through the effort to think, to kind of start afresh. And it's not to say that you won't even have whole paragraphs that might be the same, but you really need to think about it as its own piece of writing, piece of scholarship. I'll say, this may be a US thing, I'm not sure. But, well, I'll backtrack. So it's very important also to make sure that you have a clear thesis, a clear argument within your article. And what I think may or may not be unique to the US is that US publications tend to expect you to assert that argument, that thesis, focus thesis, very early in the paper, up front. We start within two paragraphs, we know what it is, we know what your main point is. That you don't kind of get there along the way, that we know it up front and then you build back to it along the way. But there's an expectation among a majority, I would say, of the US readership to state up front and clearly what the stakes are of what you're doing and what it is that you're going to argue. And I think related, again, this is about disciplining yourself to a certain extent, but then once you've made whatever claim that is, to make sure that all of the paragraphs, all of the prose that follows that, can be directly tied back to that initial thesis. I mean, it sounds very strict, but it is kind of. Doesn't mean it can't be beautiful writing on the way there, but I think there's kind of an understanding of staying rigorously focused and on topic. And I think it serves you best. You can best forward your argument if you stay on track. So again, that's kind of the issue of scope again, scope of a project. I think when it comes to the review process, that if readers can easily identify what it is that you're trying to say and follow it, then that's your halfway to publication right there. I'll say, and so again, that, I bring that up because it's a problem that I see in submissions all the time. I'll say it's important again, at least probably in your context as well, but in our context, it is important to situate your argument and your research within the existing literature. Not doing that at all looks irresponsible, but you don't want to be burdened by that and spend, you know, an article is only so long, and if you spend too much time on other people's work, then there's no room for your own. So, you know, you want to rather swiftly acknowledge the kind of relevant, related scholarship and assert how your work adds to that conversation or provides new insight. I'd say this is maybe a personal thing, but to my mind, when it comes to images, illustrations for an article, I personally feel that if you're going to include, if you're going to mention and want to illustrate an image, that you should have more than a sentence to say about it. and that may be a personal bias, but I do feel like, you know, there's an expense involved and time involved in acquiring images and permissions. And so and in the field of art history, I think not in all disciplines, it's not necessarily the case, but I think especially in the field of art history in the States, that it's good to give your images some time if you're going to include them. I'll say this sounds obvious, I'm sure, but I'll say it anyway, because again, it's not always what I encounter. Just make sure that your essay is not only well organized, which I addressed already somewhat, but also just well written. I think, again, if a reader, both the editor or a peer reviewer, can't get past the writing, and trying to kind of work way through the writing, then they're never going to get to kind of your original thinking. And so you want work hard on the presentation so that the argument can really, and your original contribution can really shine through. And I'll say too, finally, with regard to preparing an article, that I strongly advise you to ask a colleague or two to read an essay before you submit for publication. And this can be maybe asking a bit much, but I would especially recommend trying to ask someone to read who is not already familiar with your work, because someone who already knows your project can kind of fill in the blanks that might be there, that just automatically, you know, that they know where you're coming from, and they don't even realize that they understand because of a previous conversation they had with you or a seminar. Ideally, you could find, it might not even be a colleague in art history, but just a smart friend who can read your text to try to say, can I follow this from beginning to end? Where did I lose track? What did I think was important about what was the argument here? I really think it's good to get another pair of eyes on any writing, of course, but I would advise a reader or two, if possible, before formal submission. With regard to the actual submission, so now you have an article, you have research that has been formulated at a certain length and size and scope, and that you feel comfortable with and happy with in terms of its presentation. So now you have to figure out where you should submit it. And in the States at this point, there are quite a lot of good art history journals, and also visual culture journals, where, you know, not a traditional art history, but maybe with a broader focus. There are literature journals that will publish art, you know, they're interdisciplinary journals. There are many opportunities. So, but the ones, the best journals, the ones with the best reputations, are quite selective and competitive. And I would say with my own journal that the acceptance rate is probably hovers maybe 20%, maybe a little less. And I think that is typical for the kind of highest profile journals in academic journals in our field. And so you really want to make sure that you have picked the journal that is the you think is the best suited to your topic, maybe to your methodology, you know, your point of view. And so, you know, do your research about who you think will be the most sympathetic audience for the kind of work that you do. And I think that I've heard publishers say that all around, that you know, you have to think hard about where you fit best. And so just make, yeah, try to make an informed decision about that. And you know, to think about, you think about what do I read, what do I like to read, whose work do I respect, and where do they publish their work? If you have an idea, I think that this is an article that would be well suited to a particular journal, but you're not sure, you can contact an editor by email. Just to say, I mean, they're not going to read your article and give you extensive feedback and tell you if it's going to get published or not at that stage, but they can look at an abstract, short, and they can say, this could be interesting for our readers, or no, this doesn't seem like the right fit. So if you're feeling unsure, you shouldn't feel shy about that kind of inquiry. And then once you've identified a journal or journals that you think would be a good fit for your work from the point of view of method or subject matter, then you really want to think about other factors like the, as far as you know, the reputation of a journal within a field, the professionalism of that journal and what it produces, what is the end product, what you read, what does it look like, does it read well, does it look good? And I'd say here, and this, all of this advice holds true for, you know, book publishing as well, but I would recommend also aim high. You know, go for whatever journal you think is the very best, very best journal that your article might be a part of, because the chances might be lower. But I personally feel like if you have something good, it could end up in a really great journal. And if it doesn't work out, you're probably going to get good feedback, better feedback perhaps than you might have gotten from a lesser journal. Now, that's my personal take on it. I think that there could be other opinions on that, but that's my thought. I'll say here also, in the U.S., I'll preface this all by saying that in the U.S., most academic journals of repute, with a reputation, a good reputation, are peer-reviewed in a very strict sense, which is to say, and I'll speak a bit more about this in the next section, but they're submitted, the editor reviews to make sure it meets kind of the basic standards of that journal, and then we'll send out to multiple readers outside to to analyze and provide feedback. And so the first thing I was going to say here is that when you submit, you're going to submit your article, your essay, you're going to submit your images, and you usually will have to submit an abstract or a short, 150 words about summarizing your project. And that is a really important document as well. First, it's the first thing that anyone who encounters the manuscript is going to read. It may be the only thing that certain people read. So for example, I'll tell you, if I get a submission and I'm trying to think of who some reviewers, readers could be, outside readers for the manuscript, what I do is I email someone and I say, I have this manuscript, this is the title, and this is the abstract. I'll send them the abstract and say, would you maybe be interested in reading it for us? I don't send them the whole essay right away, because if they say no, then I don't really want someone's manuscript circulating more widely than it should. So, but that, I will say that oftentimes if I have a hard time getting readers to agree to review something, when I'm sending the abstract, it doesn't bode well for the final verdict, because it means people want to tend to want to review something positively, and they also are very busy, so they don't want to read something they don't think is going to be good, that's going to be a waste of their time. So you really want to get someone's attention up front, and you want to get good readers. So this is your public face, your first shot. So very important to make that abstract strong and make it clear what your new contribution is in that short amount of words. And I'll just say finally one more thing before moving on to peer review is that, and this is probably the same here, although I don't know, for journals, you really can only submit an essay one place at a time. No simultaneous submissions, they'd call it, where say you send it to three different journals in the hope that one of them will take it, and because you're running out of time. you really don't want to do that, because it takes readers, editors, and the readers, a lot of time out of their busy schedules to review texts, and it's wasting, if you send to three different publications, that's six people rather than two that have spent their time. And I've had it where someone has said, people talk. So, you don't want it to get out that you've done that. Just it's not good for your reputation. It's an abuse of the system. So I would recommend don't do that. Hopefully you're going to be with someone who will give you an answer, within a reasonable amount of time, and then you can move on if you need to another publisher. But or a journal, but please don't do that. Regarding peer review itself, timetable in the United States, as I say, pretty much everything in an academic journal does go out for a review by someone other than the editor. And I would say, in terms of your expectations, that if you submit something, you should hear within a week or so just an acknowledgement, yes, I received your essay. Thank you for sending it in. And then I think if you haven't heard, usually an editor will tell you what the time frame is for a review. But I think if they don't, and it's been, 4 months, then I think it's reasonable to ask. I think it often takes 4 months before I can get myself together and the reviews together. But after that, it's not, shouldn't be bashful about just asking about the status of your manuscript. But you should also be prepared to know that it could take some time, that there's going to be a lag between your submission and getting any feedback. In terms of how the peer review process works, I'm sure it's a little bit different with every editor, but I think that my experience is not unusual. It's probably more typical. So what I do is I look at a submission, I read it, and I think about who might have something to contribute. Some people might be interested in reading this, and what they, might have some good constructive feedback. And I tend to try to pick people who, if possible, I already know are open-minded and capable of constructive criticism. but in addition, I try to pick people who, and I think this is not unusual, people who have subject matter specialization, subject matter expertise, but aren't, if you are submitting on a Ruchet, I probably wouldn't send to another Ruchet scholar, just because sometimes it gets a little too close, and there can be, there can be battles within a very small field, and so I try to avoid that. So I might send it to someone who works on another artist. If this is Ruchet in the 60s, another person who was working on painting in the 60s or drawing, whatever the case may be, but so very close enough that they will have a strong knowledge of the field, but not so invested that they may not be able to be impartial. And so I think that's what editors, both for books and journals, try to do. You do your best, but I think that that's a goal. I think many journals do this, I send the manuscript to people who've agreed to review, along with a peer review document that has a standard set of questions that I hope that reviewer will answer for me. that helped me make an assessment of the manuscript. And these are the questions I ask. What is the author's thesis? Is the argument convincing? I mean, these are very basic questions. Is the argument convincing? Does the author position her work in relation to the existing literature? Is the writing solid? Is it strong? Is it clear? Is the text well organized? Is the author's selection and use of images appropriate for the argument? Does it offer an original contribution to the field? And is it appropriate for our journal, this particular journal? Those are very basic questions, but they're the kinds of things to keep in mind as you're writing, because those are the kinds of questions that the readers are going to be asked to answer. Most academic journals in the U.S. undergo a double-blind peer review, which means that when the essay is sent to a reader, the reader doesn't know who wrote it, but when the feedback comes back to the author doesn't know who gave the feedback either. Double blind. That's the standard system. There are other approaches, but that's what you usually will see and expect. And I tend to employ two readers for any submission. I'd probably love to have three, but it's asking a lot of professors and curators and other experts to take time to do these reviews, and we can't pay them, and so two is usually enough. If it's not, if I get back responses from two different scholars and that their feedback on an essay is very different, very different responses, then I will usually send to a third person, which can sometimes make it take longer, but I think is important. And then ultimately, the editor has to make a decision, an informed decision based on the feedback that they've gotten from others. So there is leeway on the part of the editor, but they really are making a decision that is largely informed by these other colleagues in the field. With regard to the results of a review, when you hear back, I mentioned this before, I think for the kind of top tier journals, the acceptance rates really are quite low. So, it makes sense to be prepared to get some rejections, not to set out to get rejections and be as positive as you can and do your best, but that it will happen. It happens to everyone. And that if you do get a rejection, that not to just, give yourself a day before you respond in any, give yourself a minute to think about it. You probably will get some feedback of some sort, maybe just a few sentences, maybe paragraphs and paragraphs of feedback, depending. But give yourself a little break and then go look at the feedback and think about, how it might help you or might not. It could just be that you picked the wrong journal or it happened to be the wrong readers. It could be that there were some flaws in your argument and your presentation or something, and that this feedback can help you improve your work for a submission someplace else. I will say, again, I can't emphasize this enough, that the peer reviewers are really, they're reading and responding largely, I'd say almost entirely, out of the goodness of their hearts and their desire to give back to the field. And so it's really a gift to get the feedback, and it doesn't feel like it when you have a rejection, but often I know very senior people who have had articles rejected one place, maybe not taken all the feedback, but found some things that they found were useful in the response from the original one journal and published somewhere else. So don't give up hope, but also don't be, and don't be angry either. So that's one option, is that you could get a no. And then the next option is that you could get a letter that suggests that you revise and resubmit your essay. And that's a very, from my experience, that's a very tricky category. It can mean quite a lot of things, actually. I will say this. You should never be totally discouraged by a revise and resubmit, because there is the category of no. and you didn't get a no, right? And so, and there are things that get no's. Not everything gets a revise and resubmit or a yes. There are no's, solid no's. So it is more encouraging than that, and you should be encouraged by that. However, it doesn't mean that, and I'll say also that many of the articles that I publish are the result of a revise and resubmit situation. So I'd say more of them are revisions than are ones that were yeses the first time. Yeses are reasonably rare. That said, just because you are invited to revise and resubmit and you look at feedback and you think you've addressed everything that the reviewers say doesn't guarantee publication. Because there's just nuances to this and intangibles that are really hard to, you know, pin down. And so my feeling about this increasingly over time is that if you get a revise and resubmit letter, you'll always get feedback in that case. They can't just tell you to revise but don't tell you what problems they had. So you will get some feedback about this is where we think some problems are, these are some suggestions for revision. Look at the feedback and truly think about, does this feedback resonate for me? Is this the kind of feedback that, like, oh, I understand why they're saying this. That makes total sense. I just didn't think to clarify that point. Or, oh, I should expand on this part. That makes total sense. I mean, if the feedback resonates for you, means something to you, then you should revise and resubmit. If it doesn't ring true to you, and you're just trying to meet someone else's expectations so that they'll say yes, it probably is not going to be accepted anyway, because you just can't force it. So my feeling is look at feedback in that situation and just see how you feel. See how you feel about it. If it's something that you think you can do, like, yes, I get it, I understand where the problems are, then go for it. But if it just is not really, you don't really get why they had a problem with it, or you don't like the directions that, you know, someone suggested to go, then I would recommend going elsewhere. Still maybe taking some of that feedback into consideration, but that's kind of my thought about that. And finally, I will say, in no case do you have to take all of the feedback from peer reviewers. I mean, anybody who reads an essay, we could all read the same essay and we'd all have something slightly different to say about it. I think the most powerful feedback is that which is repeated. From, you know, you have two reader reports and two people pick up on the same thing, then you really probably should address that, because other readers are probably going to pick up on that. But other than that, I think you take what you think is important, and maybe oftentimes I do this. An editor might say, you know, here's the feedback from the two readers, and then in addition, let me tell you what I think are the most important things for you to focus on. So they can sometimes help you kind of make sense of that feedback. So I will move on to academic books. I had only a tiny little bit more about journals. And mostly it's about rights and reproductions, which we'll get to later anyway. So with academic books, it's a lot of the advice is the same. I'll go more quickly because a lot of it's a repeat. A lot of the common sense, logical feedback or advice here is similar. So I will just pick up on the parts that differ, maybe for a book, than for a journal article. First is to say, again, in preparation, I'll say a couple of things. I would absolutely take advantage of the time of your, I think you do have defenses here when you finish your thesis. Do you meet and defend it to your committee? Right, so I would take that opportunity to really, when you have a captive audience of smart people in your field who are all there just to talk to you at that moment, to really ask them after it's all is said and done, you know, what do you think is truly the most important work here? Like, if I want to pursue this further, which part should I pursue, right? So it's a great time to get feedback from them, because you have a captive audience. And then I'd say, you know, again, the same way that an article is not a conference paper or a dissertation chapter, a dissertation is not a book. And so give yourself some distance if you can. Don't be afraid to throw away parts of, not throw away, but put aside parts of the dissertation that maybe don't work for this project, or maybe even your book is only part of one chapter of your original thesis. Who knows? But be flexible in your mind about what really makes sense, you know, what was forced about what I did before, and what do I want to pursue further. These are all points that are very similar from an article. Make sure that you get to the point quickly, that you stay on course with your argumentation, that you write for an audience, as big an audience as you can. And this is even more important, I think, with books, because you know, a journal has at least a subscription base, where maybe it's just institutions, but they, you know, they signed up to get the journal no matter what's in it. With a book, they choose on a book-by-book basis if they want to buy something. And so I think the issues of a readership and marketability are much more important and much more considered in book publishing world than in the journal publishing world, although of course in both. I'll say with the length, I think that your dissertation will probably be significantly longer than an average book in the United States, and probably here too, but certainly in the US. And so, you know, an average book in art history now is, you know, 300 pages or less in published form. And so, you know, there's not the attention, there's not the interest in longer books. So keep that in mind as you're writing your book manuscript, that, you know, you got to keep it, you know, short-ish chapters, short-ish book, that just is, packs a punch without being too long. And that's also about economics too, just of, you know, publishing books is expensive. So not only are people not want to buy a 500-page book, but it's expensive to produce a 500-page book. And then here, I said this kind of with articles, but I'll say even more with books. It's very expensive to publish an art history or visual culture book. And so only include books, I mean, illustrations that you absolutely need to make your points. In the States, if you are trying to get a publisher, you're going to submit a proposal, which will include a table of contents, a summary, review of related literature, many things, but all of which I kind of I have written down here. It's kind of the typical parts of that. But part of that is they want to know what your illustration program is, approximately how many illustrations and what type. And they want to know that in part because they want to know how expensive your book is going to be. And that's not to say if you need the images, you use the images. That's really, but you don't want to include things that you don't have to, that don't really contribute to your argument, I will say. And along those lines, I'm kind of jumping ahead, but I'll say both in the case of journals and in the case of books, you are probably going to be responsible for obtaining the images and the permissions to reproduce them yourself. So you're going to have to spend the time to do it, and you're going to have to pay the money to do it. There are exceptions, and for example, at my journal, we do pay authors a kind of a modest fee that helps cover a fair amount of their image and permission expenses, although they still have to do the work themselves. But most journals and books publishers in the States do not offer that. They expect you to do that. So not only, you know, from the costs are your own, right? So again, you don't want to be taking the time to search out permissions and images. You don't want to be paying for things that you don't actually need. So you want to be really smart about that. I'll say, so yeah, the typical aspects of the book proposal, I could speak to any of them. I won't now in the interest of time, but this gives you a general sense. Any university press, and there are many university presses in the United States that publish art history, quite a large number, and they all have very detailed explanations of how you're supposed to submit your book and what components you need to submit. So just follow those guidelines. That's the system. You submit, they acknowledge receipt. Similar to a journal, the editor decides, is this even something we want to consider any further? If it is, they'll get back to you and say, you know, we'd like to send this. They'll let you know we'd like to send this to some outside readers. You probably, with your book proposal, only submitted a chapter or two of your book manuscript. They may, at this point, ask for more. You may have more to give. You may not. you give them what you have. I mean, they're understanding sometimes book contracts happen when a book is completely finished. Sometimes it's not completely finished, but there's enough that, to go on to know that this is a strong project. So you have that conversation. When you submit, that you are going to have to address, you know, how far along am I with this project and when do I anticipate finishing if I haven't already. So you'll have to address that issue. I will say also when you submit, make sure that you publicize any or put forward, highlight, I'll say, any publications you already have. I think if you've already published an article or something in an anthology or something else, editors like that because they feel like they, you know, it's someone who's shown that they can produce publishable work and that they have experience in the process. So you want to really highlight that if you've had that experience. So peer review for books similar to journals. One difference I'll point out is that with books, sometimes the editor will actually ask you who you think would be a good reader, peer reviewer for your book. They may or may not take you up on that suggestion, but you know, think. I mean, are there people who, you know, you can have your dissertation advisor, but someone in the field who you think could provide useful feedback, and that's an opportunity to put people forward, and you could get someone great reading your book potentially. So that's a possibility that comes up that doesn't in the case of journals where you have no say in that. So that's kind of an interesting one. And I think the questions that are asked of the peer reviewers for books are very similar to journals, the difference being that they will also be asked these questions about market, like who do you think would read this book? You know, what's the competition for this book in the market? Like, what are the other books that are related? So they will be asked. Those are kind of the additional questions to the ones that I already outlined. In the interest of time, I'm just going to briefly mention the images and permissions thing and then open up to any questions that we might have. I will say the images and permissions are not my primary responsibility. I've had someone work with me who takes the lead on that, but I do have to deal with it on a regular basis. So as I pointed out before, usually in US, if you have an article or a book accepted, they'll say, now you have to go out and get your images and you need to get your permission. So I do have some tips about that. But just to outline, you know, there are several kinds of permissions. There's first figuring out if the work is still in copyright. And then if there is, getting that permission. And then there's, you have to get an image of a quality that's suitable for publication. So you can't just, you know, take it off the internet. Sometimes you have to scan it from a book, but usually you can't just scan it from a book. Like, you need a professional photograph of something, which you're also often going to obtain from the person or the institution that owns the object. And so you go to them for the image. They may charge you. They give you permission as well. You have to put their credit line. So I detail that a little bit here. I think that the copyright rules are a little bit different in France or in the European Union than US, although not all that different. But I should say, acquiring images and permissions can take a long time. So as soon as you've gotten an article accepted or a book accepted, start your work on it, because it can take a long time. And if you can't get an image or you can't get permission for it, you may have to change your text to accommodate that. Clearly, if it's the center object in your study, then you're in trouble. But other than that, you might be able to work around it. If you ask for permission for something you're quoted a certain fee to pay, you may have to pay, but you can ask to negotiate. You can try to negotiate that fee down to say, you know, just to remind you, this is a nonprofit scholarly press. The print run is modest. This is all for educational purposes. You know, there's no money being made in these operations, and so oftentimes you can go back and appeal and you might get your fee reduced. And so you shouldn't be shy about asking. They get asked all the time. They can still say no, but it's worth the ask if the fee seems high. Make sure that you do keep track of all of your image and permission paperwork, because your press will want it to prove that you got the permissions that you need. And in fact, also there can be cases where you try to get permission for something, you contact an individual who owns a work of art, you write them, you know where they live, you send them letter, you send them email, they just don't respond. If they don't respond, they don't respond. You can move forward, but you want to be able to prove that you've tried. So you keep your files. So if someone comes back to you, you say, you know what, I wrote a letter on this date, I wrote a letter on this date, I made a phone call on this date, and no response, and so I made my effort. So just make sure you keep track of your permission inquiries. The thing that's tough about our history books is that they are more expensive to produce than most because of issues of copyright and image reproduction. And so, and often it's coming out of your own pocket, and it's hard, especially as students and young professors, to accommodate that. So, but there are answers. I mean, sometimes university departments can help. If you have a contract in hand, can provide support. You can apply to, I don't know how the system will work here. I know that in the United States that is a possibility sometimes. And then there are increasingly are some grants, publishing grants. Latera has a few for specific reasons, and there are a few others. Most of these you cannot apply for unless you already have a book contract. But don't be afraid to pursue publication just because you're not sure you can afford it. I mean, deal with that later. They can say yes, and then you'll work it out. Someone, you'll tell them, I can't do this, and it'll work out. I mean, it's important to push forward your work. And so there are ways to make it happen, and increasingly, hopefully increasingly, funds that can support our work.